Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Now let's meet what his publishers have been saying is Ireland's answer to crime writer Lee Child. Charlie is the newly published novel by author Finn Oag, which is the pen name of a man who's kept his thriller writings basically as a secret from colleagues and maybe even family for a time at home as well. Finn Oag's real name is Andy Martin. He's a very experienced journalist over many years with the BBC and he's with us in studio. Welcome, Andy.
Hiya.
Congratulations on this coming out of sorts.
Yeah, it is. It's a bit nerve-wracking.
Is it really?
Yeah.
So your day job is BBC and you moonlight as a writer, is that basically?
Yeah.
Tell us about your current affairs job or what you do for the BBC, first of all. We get to know you.
Well, I look after podcasts and documentaries and comedy and some drama for the network, for Radio 4 and for BBC Sounds and for Radio Ulster. Our sort of main product is a podcast called Assume Nothing, which is an investigative podcast. But for quite a few years, I was the BBC's Ireland correspondent. And yes. Before that, I was in investigations on TV and in radio.
And an Ireland correspondent for the BBC really means the north, doesn't it, in most
well,
of the time?
No, I mean, not during the bailout. You know, I was lashed to a camera in Dublin for,
that was your time.
For a good few years. And yeah, I mean, we covered the whole island. We covered the whole island for BBC World and for World Service and for the network radio, yeah. So it was a whole island.
And very well travelled as a journalist? You did serious stints around the place?
Yeah, well, years ago, yeah. I spent a bit of time in the Middle East, got a few opportunities to go other places and cover some big events. Went freelance for a while and as a video journalist, trotted around the place. It was great crack.
You're up
great
for crack. Adventure. Basically.
So
very few, if any, of your colleagues have known about the sideline as with the thriller novels.
Yeah, I mean, just my boss, because we have to declare personal interest. Yeah, but no, very, very few people know that I've been doing this.
Even family members?
Most of my family, I think, know now, but I don't think they always knew. Yeah, it was
you
just something that I wanted to do. I wanted to write a book before I was 30 and I got so tied up in journalism that I didn't do it. And then I wanted to write one before I was 40. And then one night I'm on the water a lot. And one night one of my daughters was on the boat and I just thought I better do this. And I started writing and this is what came out.
All right. Mm. And what's the secrecy about, or what were you sort of embarrassed about?
A lot of the stories have a genesis in things that have happened. So as a journalist, you come across a lot of stories. You can't always tell those stories. Mm-hmm. Some of them actually run into the ground or don't, you know, you can't prove.
Can't back them up sufficiently for broadcast.
Exactly kind of thing, that, you know, but you know that they happened. And so this is maybe an outlet for some of those stories. That's not to say that these are factual books. These are absolutely not factual books.
Thank God for that disclaimer.
I know.
It gets wild.
But, you know, they probably have a springboard somewhere, in fact.
So it is kind of grounded in your journalism. Was it a surprise to people then when you said this, or that you're kind of, do they react and say, what are you?
I'll tell you after this.
They're only finding out now.
Yeah. Yeah,
most. But you've three daughters, your immediate family. They know now, obviously, and they're kind of.
I have two stepdaughters and a daughter. Yeah, they have no interest in this whatsoever. Absolutely not.
Never read them.
No, not at all. Not at all. Okay. No, they have absolutely no interest in this. I showed them the cover once, and they said, "Yeah, very good." That was it.
It's like I said at the start, is manly books are turned
but,
off.
But this is the thing. I'm not sure that they are, because I know that most of the people who read them are actually women.
Is that right? That's the problem, though, with books in general, isn't it? It's mostly women who pick them up and read them.
Well, I mean, I have no problem with it, because, you know, as long as the reviews are good, I am content, you know. Yeah. But I do remember that.
You self-published these all quietly, didn't you?
Yeah.
That was 6 or 7 years ago, around then?
Was it 9 years ago, maybe, the first one?
And so then, this has been picked up. It's the first time it's in hard copy.
That's right, yeah. So a publishing company has taken them on now, and then they want a certain number of books a year. So I've just finished the fifth book now. I just finished it 2 days ago, so it's gone off to the editor.
Yeah. And you mentioned you spend a lot of time on the water. So your other interests outside of journalism and writing is sailing. Sailing where?
Yeah, well, Strangford Lough mainly, but, you know, we sail all around Ireland and we've sailed abroad in competitions and what have you. But we now run a commercial boat as well, so I do a bit of commercial skippering.
But you like filling every available time in your day, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And you do like, that's a business you run with them.
Yeah, my brother and I have a water sports business on Strangford Lough. It's an activity centre. And
is that where you're from and where you live now?
Yeah, We live and work on Strangford Lough on the northeast.
Lovely county down.
It is, yeah. It's a beautiful place.
It's a good place. It's getting a lot better covers than Lough Neagh, that's for sure.
I know, poor Lough Neagh, yeah. I know. Yeah. It's hard for the people up there.
It could be flying. But Strangford Lough, so you are a serious sailor. Do you have a big long sailing boat and everything?
Well, we used to race quite a lot.
Did you?
Yeah. And we got to race in World Championships in Australia and New Zealand and in Spain, but we haven't been doing that for a few years now because the business took over. So we're now on motorboats and kayaks and paddle boards and all that sort of stuff.
I love what you say, kind of dismissively. You know, it's not real boating, but it's scary for the rest of us. And so, out of this kind of experience of all the sailing I mentioned, is because this Jack Reacher figure, who is Sam Ireland, he lives on a boat in the north.
On a boat,
Who is this based on? I wonder.
Yeah.
And because I thought it was curious, particularly because you got the kind of Rod Alona, Dean Koontz, all those kind of they're always like, you know, mega global, globally skilled, you know, kind of Marines, which is quite hard to find a believable character in Ireland, you know,
if it had been born down here, he would have been a ranger or something.
He would have been a ranger, yeah. But then for kind of a broader audience, they wouldn't believe that Ireland has kind of, you know, world class.
But they do.
Marine, yeah.
But they do.
They're just quietly there. But so you pick the British Army.
Yeah, well, principally because that was the point of reference that I had where I grew up. You know, there was a lot of military around, and so I could hear the dynamic between the sort of plummy brass and the ratings, if you like, and you know, a lot of that informed probably my take on how the military worked. And also because of the work that I was doing at the BBC, we had the opportunity really to, well, we had to go for specific training for hostile environments, and so you would be exposed to a lot of special forces people as a result of the training that you go through in order to be deployed in foreign places. And so all you needed to do was listen to them talking about what they did, and then that informs, and then you've got contacts here in special forces, and you can, you know, you can tap them up to make sure that what you're saying is accurate. And but, you know, Sam isn't, you know, it's not all guns. It's, you know, it's a lot of the reviews suggest that, you know, it's more realistic than some of the more far-fetched heroes.
Right, okay.
But at least that's what I'm reaching for.
You don't have to suspend too much disbelief. It's interesting because Hollywood gives the Navy SEALs a great run out, but you don't hear as much I presume they're in the British Royal Navy, are they? The SBS, there's a special
SBS,
boat squadron. You don't hear, they don't get as much of a look out in the films, do they?
No, they don't. They don't. But I mean, that characterization was just a means by which to explain his ingenuity, really.
Former commando, SBS.
Well, yeah. And it's but really that whole part of his life is secondary to the character as it develops through the four or five novels, you know.
And are they a post World War II kind of frogmen?
No, they did operate in the Second War, and they were deployed in the Second War. They were sort of thrown out of submarines and sent ashore before wetsuits.
What's the difference between them and the SAS, which you think we'd be?
Just airborne and seaborne.
The SAS is the...
Yeah.
And the language and everything you use, you obviously met a lot of these guys and chatted to them. Is that where the research comes?
That's it, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and also I know some, obviously. You know, I would have friends who would have served as well, and I just listened to them. But they don't know that I was listening with a view to writing novels about it. You know, there are people who would have served in those regiments in the long distant past as well. I mean, these regiments are not without controversy. If you've seen any of what Panorama has covered in recent years, you know about the way they were operating in Afghanistan. And the fifth novel will touch on that, or will deal with that in, you know, some detail. So it's not to lionize or anything. It's just to explain why he has the skill set.
It's hinted quite a lot of as well, isn't it? That he carries this kind of guilt and the things that have happened.
And a disregard for his for his senior officers, I think.
Essential in an ex-commando in an action thriller, isn't it? Disregard for the top brass. In all of the thrillers as well, you have to travel around the globe, which is useful because the story begins in Gaza. Mm. And I thought, he's really going controversial here.
But that was 9 years ago. Mm. You know, so that book was written 9 years ago and it's probably largely applicable now, but I couldn't have predicted that.
Oh, extraordinary! You just did this now because and it's quite measured in a sense because the initial mission is, isn't it? It's basically Hamas are getting Semtex smuggled in on an aid ship.
That's right.
But there's an air raid by the IDF, so you're covering issues on both sides there.
Yeah, and those kickoff points happened while I was working in. I was living in East Jerusalem at the time, and and that's where all of that. The grinding of that story came from, and then there are elements of abuse and what have you, which is also grounded in fact.
Just staying with the Middle East part, there's quite a lot of detail of streets of Gaza and so on. Did you as a reporter?
We were throughout. We were living in East Jerusalem and traveling throughout the area and Jordan and Egypt, and then we ended up in East Africa as it happened, but. So we were right through that area at the time. I was freelance. I wasn't working for the BBC then. Myself and a cameraman photographer were working.
How do you stay safe when you're a freelancer in there?
You just keep your head. Well, you don't have the supports that the BBC would provide, of course.
Yeah.
We employed a fixer, Waleed, who appears in book two, and. He was just the best crack all over. This guy was so funny. Could speak Yiddish, Hebrew, and Arabic, and was ostensibly a taxi driver. And any time he came to an IDF checkpoint, he threw on a yarmulke. He had the keffiyeh.
He could switch,
and they couldn't tell. They couldn't tell.
Oh, that's a real person.
A real person, and he was honestly a genius. And his wife was Christian. He was Muslim, and he could dance through roadblocks. And he was just an extraordinary guy. I learned so much from him.
And are you still in touch? Is he still?
No, I lost touch with him after we left. I did try to get in touch with him a couple of times, but I don't even know if he's still alive.
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah,
but it's probably part of his modus operandi: lose touch with people.
Maybe, but an extraordinary person. Yeah,
it has all sorts of complex puzzles in my head. This book, because one of the best crack is kind of like Sam Ireland going around the place trying to be undetected, because he basically goes to Dublin and he meets a human rights charity and they set him off on these kind of illegal missions to take vengeance on bad guys, isn't that?
That's right.
The earlier part of it, and then it takes off into a wider plot.
Yeah.
And there is the theme of abuse in there, and it's pretty ghastly.
Yeah.
And it's the same for every crime novelist. You're kind of inventing stuff, but it's drawn in real life.
Well, very much it is, unfortunately. Yeah. So some of the stories in there were stuff that was related to me at the time. Some of the characters in there are very much grounded in people who exist or existed. And some of the stories that were told, I mean, that's not to say that they are true stories, but they are certainly stories that were told to me.
Ones that you couldn't back up, as I say, for...
Couldn't back up or, maybe just weren't completely sure that there was veracity in them.
And when there's doubt, you just leave it out as the kind of...
Yeah, I mean,
you have to be 100% sure, isn't that?
Absolutely. Well, there's no point in doing it if there's no point in writing something that's not true. It doesn't serve anybody.
But you've also hit the kind of the real kind of stress of journalism, and it's a good way to channel it into fiction, isn't it? Did you feel a relief then?
Yeah, that might be some of the reason for writing these books is to get the stories out that you couldn't tell.
I mentioned the kind of puzzles, which I really enjoy, like solving those kind of issues of how Sam Ireland's going to get from the north to Dublin undetected by anything, because the M1 has cameras everywhere.
Mm.
And is it a spoiler to say, because it's quite early enough in the book, he goes by boat, which I presume you've done. Very quick, actually. Was it 4 hours or something?
I mean, it would take you no time. I've done it so many times, I've done it slowly as well, but Yeah, actually, I was coming just round the East Link there today, and part of it is about the abuse of seafarers on ships. You know, that's all based on one character who I jumped on and off ships with around Ireland for about a year. And we had so much crack, Oliver. Honestly, it was fantastic. And I had this. Maybe you're tight for time, and do tell me.
No, not at all. No, it's a trade union official, isn't it?
Yeah,
who works on international shipping companies, and they get an alert from somewhere, and the ship is coming heading towards Ireland. That's the place where
that's
he.
Right.
Boards. That's a.
And so he's Fran in the book, and he and I had a secret camera in my puffer jacket. And I was filming all of this, and because I was with him all the time, I used to have to push my chest up, you know, in between him and whoever he was arguing with. And he could arrest a ship. He could basically get Dublin Port shut down, jump on a pilot boat, get out to the ship. They would throw down a rope ladder, would climb up the rope ladder, jump on, and they would think it was the pilot to bring the ship in. So not all of the ship's captains are allowed to bring a ship into a port.
Yes, that was interesting, yeah.
And he and they would say, are you the pilot? And he would say, no, I'm from the ITF. I'm going to arrest this ship. And he would arrest the ship at sea, and they wouldn't be able to bring it in.
And when you're saying close down Dublin Port, it's the International Shipping Company that fault, not Dublin Port.
Of course, yes. Absolutely, yes. So he would close down the ship coming into the port, and he would unionise everybody on the ship. And then because I'm sticking my chest in between him and whoever he's having a barney with, they thought that I was his minder.
Because you're a tall fella,
they must have thought I was very, very confident, but it was actually because I was trying to get a good shot. And then we would jump off the ship whenever it came into port. But I mean, that was an extraordinary year that I spent with him making
a
documentary.
So this is all drawn on reality.
And actually, the conversations are almost verbatim because I have them on tape. You know,
it's a much overlooked story, isn't it? The kind of the ships at sea all around the world were essentially modern day slavery. And even when your union friend fixes the problem, they just bring in another group, don't they? They just sack the unionised ones. It's
They changed the name of the ship on one occasion and sailed out again. That was it.
So you can come undetected by boat into Dublin until you get to Dublin. That's you're a bit of a spy yourself in many ways. Ghost writing is also a sideline, or was.
It was, yeah. I don't think I'll do any more of them, but yeah, the ghost writing is. It's a funny industry, that, you know, where you you basically write a book and send it off to somebody, and then they make whatever changes they make and they publish.
So ghostwriting, people would be familiar with memoirs, where the person is known, whoever the journalist or the writer is, has partnered with the public figure. But you're talking about the ghostwriting where it's an actual novel, it's a work of fiction?
A work of fiction, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
With someone else's name on it.
Someone else's name, yeah.
And some people couldn't tell us, for example, who you've written for, because...
No, because they... you know, they obviously insist on non-disclosure agreements and what have you in advance, you know. But it's quite an established way of doing things, you know. Some people who, you know, have, you know, 70 or 80 books in a series.
Right.
You know.
Irish authors, presumably American more so.
I don't know. I haven't done any for Irish authors anyway. But, it's quite a... It's hard to know what to say about that.
Is it a good job? Does it pay well?
It pays well, yeah. It does pay well. I mean, it's worthwhile in that it probably gives you enough breathing space to be able to pursue your own.
Right, without the complications of your name attached to it or whatever.
Well, exactly that, because I was and remain nervous about putting my name to the books. I don't
Not anymore,
really,
Stephen.
I know you've
I hope it goes well for you. So there are four books in the Sam Ireland. How many books?
Five.
Yeah. So this is the first one out.
That's the first
one. You putting them out very regularly, or
how? Yeah. So the publishing company, I think, will release the next two. I think Charlie, the first book. Hopefully, they gradually get better as I find my feet as a writer. But they.
I did see somewhere you had said that you think this is the worst of your books, which I'm sure your publisher is saying, stop speaking out loud.
I'm sure they will. Yeah. But the
well, that's a confidence.
The second book is better. The third book, people, the reviews anyway that come back, because you can see them on Amazon, you know, they call that one the real deal. I don't know if it is or not, but it certainly felt to me like the you know, the better book. And then there's 4 and 5 now as well. So
they are set up nicely. You have a lovely conclusion that you get a complete story here, but you're kind of nodding that there are more adventures to be had.
Yeah.
And the locations, I think, are the most fun. Like you go to Boston, Lithuania with some bad guys there.
Well, I was, yeah.
And the climactic moment is in a familiar street to people in Belfast.
Yeah. That whole Lithuania thing happened largely. Well, you know, the journey. We found a fixer on the plane. We were over there doing a story, and that fixer was as she spoke. It was good crack. She got us into the court. All of that happened. Yeah.
Really?
Mm.
I thought that, and I was thinking this is the most implausible vignette that you've published.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a bit of killing involved, but that did not happen.
Yeah,
but the
disclaimer supreme.
She was a real person, yeah.
I bet you know this. This is from a texter, says Jim Grant, also known as Lee Child, another pen name.
Right.
His father came from Cypress Avenue in Belfast.
Mm.
That's from Bob, who was chatting to us earlier on in the show. It's like a big WhatsApp group here.
Yeah.
It was a Belfast connection.
Lee Child is the real deal. Like, I mean, he's the best thriller writer in the world, isn't he? It's a bit embarrassing to be discussed at the same time.
This is what publishers will do,
but, you know,
but like you must go along with it.
Yeah.
Finn Oak, also known as Andy Martin. I hope you don't get any unpleasant messages today from colleagues going, what are you at? You've compromised everything.
You're right on your ear.
But it's fascinating, given what you've told us about the research and how close to reality this is. It kind of gives me a different look at it as well. The book is called Charlie by Finn Oak. It's been good. Thanks for coming down to us and
having
a chat,
having
Andy. Safe on the water.
Thanks a million.
On your kayaks, even though you're looking down your nose. And good luck for the next 4 or 5, whether they are back soon after these. Email